Vlad Lodok will call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:13 p.m. Friday, April 30th, 2021. Development quorum, we have everybody here. Representative McKay, Representative Fields, Representative Kronk, Representative Schrage, Representative Gillum, Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, Vice Chair Hopkins, myself, Representative Putkadup. I'd like to give our thanks to the recording secretary on the airwaves, Robin, and our LIO moderator, Doug. Please silence all your cell phones and place them up on a notepad so we aren't interrupted by that. We have a couple items formally on today's agenda. That's House Bill 135, the continuation of the committee discussion on the geothermal resources. And with us today, we have the Department of Natural Resources members to speak to it. We also have House Bill 120, which is the first hearing of state land sales and leases, including rivers, by the Department of Natural Resources. We're also given notice by Representative Schrage to reconsider the vote on House Bill 98. I think with that, I can disregard that phone call, I think. With that, we'll take up the reconsideration of the vote now. Vice Chair Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, I move House Resource Committee substitute for House Bill 98, Work Order 32-GH1607/B from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Schrage, if you'd like to speak to your reconsideration.
Perfect, thank you. Yeah, I was just about to object to do just that and appreciate the committee's indulgence in picking this bill up again due to my reconsideration. You know, I really wrestled with this bill. I want to see our resources developed, and I think that our timber harvests play a large role in moving Alaska forward and seeing more production here in our state. It's a goal that I want to help to move forward. At the same time, I'm really struggling with this bill because in my mind it cuts out too much public process in support of increased production. I mean, studying through this bill, the fact that it cuts out basically any public process if the sale is less than 500,000 board feet really gives me a lot of trouble. And with that, I just need a little more time to think about how I was going to vote on this bill, but ultimately can't support it. So I'm going to vote the same way, but appreciate, again, the committee's indulgence in taking this up again.
Thank you, Representative Schrage. If there's anyone else that would like to speak under the discussion on the reconsideration, you're more than welcome to. If not, we'll take it to the vote. I will maintain my objection for that purpose. Grace, can you please give us a roll call on it?
Representative McKay?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Kronk?
Yes.
Representative Hopkins?
No.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Representative Gillum?
Yes.
Representative Schrage?
No.
Chair Petkovic?
Yes. And with 5 yeas, 4 nays, the reconsideration on House Bill 98 stands the same, and it is moved from committee. With that, we will go on to the next item on the agenda, and that's House Bill 135. But I'm going to take a brief at ease for a minute or two real quick. back on the record. House Resources, we're going to take up another hearing on House Bill 135 regarding geothermal resources. Joining us today, we've got Haley Payne, Sean Clifton, and Steve Masterman. I believe we also are joined by Martin Pansons, but he might be speaking to the other bill. Last meeting, we had some back and forth discussions, asked for some clarification on some of the slide presentations and more information. I believe we've gotten some responses from DNR formally and should have been posted to BASIS and distributed to committee members. And with that, can the department or somebody within the department walk us through some of those backups that were provided?
Good afternoon. This is Haley Payne, Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, for the record. First off, I just want to thank the committee again for their time and for being willing to continue this discussion on HB 135 geothermal resources. We did, in response to the last hearing, send some additional materials as background. Specifically, there were questions that Representative Fields and Representative Hannon had that we would like to come back and bring some of that information for. So we did send forward a couple of attached documents, as well as an email that explained a little bit more about preferential rights. So perhaps to start, I can turn it over to Director Masterman, who will introduce the images that were sent over of the geothermal facilities in response to Representative Hannah's question about the size of the infrastructure that's necessary for geothermal development.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Deputy Director Payne. For the record, this is Steve Masterman, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, calling in from Fairbanks. And yes, in response to Representative Hannon's question, I got on the internet and searched for some images of geothermal power plants of a range of sizes. And so the document has pictures of four power plants ranging in size from 10 megawatts on the small end to 303 megawatts on the large end. And for the committee's reference, that the largest power plant shown there, the Hellisheiði power plant in Iceland, is the second largest individual power plant in the world. So it's at the very top end of the scale for power plants, and there are very few of that size. In the United States, there's two large geothermal fields, both in California. The Salton Sea geothermal field has 10 power plants that cumulatively have a capacity of 340 megawatts. So on average, there would be 34 megawatts, and so similar to the second picture of the power plant there from Turkey, which is a 50-megawatt power plant. And then the Geysers geothermal complex in Northern California has 18 power plants that cumulatively generate 900 megawatts of power. So it's sort of, you know, it's all the range from 10 megawatts on the small end to almost a gigawatt on the top end. But you can see the size of the power plants varies from, you know, a small warehouse to a major industrial complex, just depending on the size of the geothermal resource and the capacity to use the power. So, you know, say a Pilgrim Hot Springs, for example, if the power company were extremely fortunate and discovered a power a system that could, you know, support a 300 megawatt power plant, there isn't 300 megawatts of demand, so that they wouldn't get built. They would build something to meet the demand on the Seward Peninsula. So power plants are sized to the scale of the geothermal field and also to the demand for power. So hopefully this provides a little bit of perspective for you to see the very scale of facilities. Chena Hot Springs, hundreds of is a smaller facility than the smallest one shown on these images. So if there are any further questions on that, I'd be happy to dive in more.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. We've got Representative Fields and Representative Hannon.
Thanks through the chair, Mr. Masterman. I'm just curious if there's generally a relationship between the size of the generating facility and the price per megawatt hour. In other words, as the facilities get larger in general, does that drive the price down, or is it very or is that not generally true and it's site specific?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I would say that is generally true, but it is going to have a site-specific component. So putting a power plant out in, you know, the Seward Peninsula is going to probably be more expensive per megawatt than it would be in, you know, Southern California, just because of the location and the construction cost and the remoteness, et cetera.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields and Mr. Masterman. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Masterman, thank you for the additional visuals. They were very helpful for me. You sent us a notated paper from the University of Michigan Center for Sustainable Systems, and one of the notes in it was that there are 16 national laboratories and research institutions in the U.S. conducting research into geothermal energy technologies. And it occurred to me, we've not talked about whether the University of Alaska system that has a degree in volcanology, are they engaged with you in this research?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes. We actually have worked in the past with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. We had a collaborative research project with them on Pilgrim Hot Springs. And they're pretty engaged in sort of the development of small power plants for remote communities. And so we would work with them probably specifically on this. And you're correct. There are a number of national laboratories, and the Department of Energy is particularly engaged in geothermal research.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon and Mr. Masterman. And I believe during the presentation we talked a little bit about potential projects that might pursue some of what this legislation changes as far as taking advantage of geothermal power production. And I think we took a look at something in the Nome area as far as the Pilgrim Hot Springs. And I remember during the discussion we talked about megawatt needs potentially. And I guess just looking at the size comparison of some of the different you know, pictures that you provided as far as what these, depending on the megawatt production, what these things look like, I guess. Can you remind me again what Nome areas, I think, between the graphite mine or Nome proper, there was a megawatt need thrown out there, and I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was in like the 10 to 15 megawatt range.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. Nome, I believe, has a power consumption around 6 megawatts, and the mine would be about the same. So combined, they would be about 12. So they'd be closest to the smallest installation shown here.
Thank you for that, Mr. Masterman. Visualization helps on it. So Representative Brousher.
Yeah, appreciate it through the chair. Thank you for the presentation. But I just have a few questions, and maybe they've been covered before. But what is the temperature of the fluid coming up out of the ground and the temperature of the steam as it goes through? It says high temp steam. And I just want to understand the process and how it happens and how deep you have to go to achieve that temperature.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in particular Pilgrim Hot Springs, the surface waters, I believe, are about 50 degrees centigrade, and the hottest temperatures that have been encountered in drilling are about 92 degrees centigrade at a depth of about 120 meters, and then the temperature declines below that. And the chemistry of the fluids suggests that the geothermal reservoir has a temperature of around 150 degrees centigrade, but that has not been found by drilling yet. So geothermal systems around the world mostly produce from the hot water. So the temperature of the hot water is generally going to increase with depth up to a maximum temperature in the reservoir, and that varies system by system. So at Pilgrim, the evidence suggests the maximum temperature is, you know, 150 degrees centigrade, but in some of these systems around the world, if you drill down, you know, the temperature of the water can be substantially hotter than boiling point just because the boiling point is raised by the water pressure, by the depth. So that some of these systems are tapping into temperatures in the 200 to 300 degree centigrade range and bringing that water up to the surface. So, you know, it's a very site-specific answer to your question, I guess, is the short response there.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, we brought up 135 just to cover some follow-up questions and the backup material that was provided. But if there are any other further questions that stem from this conversation, feel free. And if there's any further follow-up documentation or presentation needed, you can either get a hold of myself and Grace, and we can work with the department to provide that, or you can get a hold of the department directly. With that, last call for any questions, comments, or concerns in regards to House Bill 135 before we move on to the next item. Okay, well, seeing or hearing none, I want to, I guess, echo the sentiment of gratitude and thanks for the ability to be able to communicate this geothermal industry that's out there, and want to thank the department for walking us through the details of that. So we'll set the bill aside and move on to House Bill 120 now, which is our first hearing, and we'll turn to some of the other folks from the department online. I believe Mr. Parsons is available.
Good afternoon, Chairman Tuck. Can you hear me all right?
Good afternoon, Mr. Parsons. Yes, we can. I'd just also like to note that for helping with the questions and answers, we've got Department of Law online with Christopher Orman, and also Division of Agriculture, David Sade. Take a brief at ease. And Mr. Parsons, sorry, before we go to the introduction and the discussion of the bill, we actually have a companion bill that's moving on the other side that has had changes already, and so we don't bog down this committee with something that's irrelevant. We're going to look to adopt a CS first, and with that, Representative Rauscher.
Yes, I move that the House Resources adopt CS for HB 120, Work Order 32-GH1634/B as our working document.
And I'll object, again, just for the purposes of lining it up with what has happened in the Senate. We're just making a conforming change. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing or hearing none, the committee substitute passes the committee. Now we have a amended document that we're working with, and that should be in your binder. And now I'll give the floor over to Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Chairman Puckatuck. For the record, this is Marty Parsons. I'm the Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water within the Department of Natural Resources. So I'll take a minute here to walk through some of the highlights of what the CS for HB 120 does. We've taken some of the more controversial issues out of the bill. If those come up, they'll come up separately. But this bill is really another step in Governor Dunleavy's how to get Alaska lands into Alaskans' hands, and it provides for some new aggressive processes for getting lands into development. One of the first things that it does is it harmonizes the statutes that are contained within the Department of Transportation and Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. Currently, there are statutes under Title 38, which are those that DNR operates under, that would allow, in this case, DOT to dispose of lands that they procured specifically for a purpose that they needed, like maybe a right-of-way or through a condemnation for a lot of land, a parcel of land that in the future didn't need. They could directly dispose of that as opposed to conveying it back to or conveying it to the Department of Natural Resources. This would only be for lands that were either specifically given to the state for purposes of Department of Education, Early Childhood Development, or for DOT. Those statutes exist. under Title 38 do not exist in the statutes that govern either DEED or DOT, and this particular bill provides basically harmonizes those statutes. Okay, so that was on page 2. Moving to page 3, one of the other things it does is it basically brings the LDIF, which is the legislature.
Mr. Parsons?
Yes.
Sorry, just for the opportunity to be transparent, can you speak a little bit to some of the things that were stripped in the Senate that we just adopted with the CS, just to...
Absolutely, Chairman Tuck. So the primary issue that was taken out was the original bill would have repealed the statutes that, and the planning effort that established the recreational rivers and the Matanuskas who sit in a river basin. That's a plan and statutes that were adopted in the late 80s, early 90s. A lot of things have changed since that time. But it is a very controversial issue. There are lots of user groups that have interest in how that might have been either repealed or how it might have been amended. So we at the department and through the governor's office decided it was best to remove that. And if we get it taken up, we will take that up as a separate issue, or potentially the governor will determine that it's in the best interest to seat the board that's established under the current Rec Rivers Act to make those amendments. So that was better handled elsewhere, so we pulled that out of the bill. We changed some language under the agriculture portion that Director Shady will speak to that better clarified what we were trying to accomplish there. So we didn't remove that from the bill, we just clarified some of the language.
Thank you for that. You can continue with your actually there's a question in regards to that. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Parsons, in particular, when I first read this bill, the deed properties drew my attention. And so I'm wondering if we have, as opposed to all state land, which is millions of acres, my presumption is one that the properties held by the Department of Education and Early Development are a finite list, and I'm wondering whether we have access to that, and I'm looking to understand how many of them are buildings, because it does reference buildings, and how many of them are raw land. Because stepping out from that, my speculation is all the deed properties are going to be in communities, and I want to make sure that disposing of them gives some right of first refusal to a local government or a school district before it goes on the open market. But if I'm perceiving that all wrong, correct me. So I'm wondering if we have a list of the deed properties and this statute change would cover.
Absolutely. Representative Hannah, through the chair. Through our research, we found about 5 properties that were deeded to DEED. They would be in Fort Yukon, Wales, Shishmaref, and Teller. There were some lands in Sitka for the Mount Edgecombe School that have already been dealt with. So right now we can find about 5. So yes, it is a very finite universe that we would be dealing with. And it would be up to DEED to determine how they disposed of those lands. It I believe in the language it talks about through a decision or, through standards and conditions established by the commissioner. So the commissioner of DEED would determine how they would dispose of those lands.
Okay. I guess one follow-up.
Representative Vanna.
Are all 5 of those buildings? So I'm assuming former Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools that at one point the state looked at taking over, which is what Mount Edgecombe is. But is that accurate that all 5 of those properties are former schools, probably federal?
Representative Hannah, through the chair, I will have to check on exactly what those are. my recollection is you are correct. Those were schools or some type of facility associated with the school that were deeded to the state at statehood for the state to take over those responsibilities. But if you don't mind, I would like to verify exactly what is contained on those parcels.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I had a similar question related to DOTPF land. I'm guessing that DOTPF typically owns wider right-of-way than they're using or frequently owns it. And I guess I'm curious, are there also larger DOT parcels that are out there? And if so, where are they? So that would be one question. Definitely want to see a map of that, or maybe multiple maps given the scale of our state. And then second question, if I'm understanding this correctly, a lot of these provisions, sections 5, section 6, 7, I think 8 through 11, are affecting DNR lands. So, you know, near my district, the Hatcher Pass area has an interesting mix of land, I think including just some state land that's not otherwise designated for recreational purposes. People use it for recreation. So I would also like to see a map, at least in South Central, say within an hour drive time of Anchorage, about land that is going to be affected by this bill and sort of what the impacts could be in terms of current uses, just so I can think through, if we do this, you know, are we effectively taking land out of the public trust in a place like Hatcher Pass that is, you know, very heavily visited by people in the region for recreation? So just want to understand that in kind of the real world, looking at where the parcels are. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. And Mr. Parsons, I'm not sure that was requiring a question or the answer, just the follow-up documentation. But yeah. I don't want to get ahead of your presentation if perhaps some of this stuff is covered in that, if you can let me know of. But also, in addition to Rep. Fields' request for follow-ups, I think if we just had a presentation on overall statewide general effects of lands that this bill would have, and then kind of a little zoom in on each of those little particulars, that'd be helpful for the committee. And I'll allow you to, I guess, shed some light on that, Mr. Parsons, before we go to the next question.
Thank you, Chair Puckett.
And could I just do a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Fields.
So with those specific questions submitted to the department, and thanks, Mr. Parsons, for doing the follow-up, I want to ask a more general question, which is, when you did this, could you explain the thought process in terms of, you know, where these lands are in relation to recreational uses or other kind of traditional uses that may or may not conflict with liquidation? Thank you.
Mr. Parsons.
Representative Field, through the chair, I'm not sure I understand the question completely. Are we talking about just DOT lands or general state lands?
More broadly, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Fields. So in this bill, at the disposal that we're speaking of, in this case, is only for those lands that DOT would have acquired specifically for DOT purposes. It does not include general entitlement land that the state would have received from the federal government as part of this, part of the Statehood Act. So if DOT would have gone out and say there was an area they needed to expand the capital, that they then went and had done some type of a prescriptive action to take that land over, and then later that wasn't going to be used for that specific purpose, and DOT no longer had a reason to hold on to it, under this bill they would have the opportunity to dispose of those lands through their statutes and regulations, as opposed to conveying it to DNR, and then DNR going through its process of receiving it and going through its process of then disposing of it. So it takes some of the red tape out of the process, shall we say, of allowing DOT to dispose of those lands that they specifically acquired for their projects.
Got it. So maybe I misunderstood this. So this bill does not affect at all generally owned state land such as that managed by DNR. So the Hatcher Pass hypothetical, a lot of state land around Hatcher Pass, is not something that I even need to be concerned about. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Fields, through the chair, that is correct. Under the DED and the DOT portions of the bill, which I believe are sections 1 and 3, then no. There's no concern there. That's just specific lands that were acquired for their purposes, not general state land, land affected by LDAs or any of those types of things.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. I'll try to be brief, but I'm going to bounce off of what our Representative Hammond has said, basically concerning buildings. In my district, Delta has a school, which they are no longer using. It's an elementary school. And the removal cost about $6 million because of stuff like asbestos, which they used back in the 60s and 70s. So I'm just wondering, and I know you have not a list yet in your possession of the buildings that were identified, but I was just wondering if concerns like that were identified in choosing these buildings and the cost that it would take to actually dispose of them should somebody bid on them, and whether or not those kind of hazards will be identified in your process. Thank you.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, we, again, these are only buildings that the federal government would have given to the state, to Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. As I said, we've only identified about 5, but we will certainly go back through the list to make sure that we have identified all of those parcels that we know of, and DEED may be able to provide a larger list of buildings that may be set on federal land or on community property that would not be part of this, because DNR really, unless we marry the titles of what the building was and the land, then we are only disposing of the land. And if we have harmonized the title, then we would do both the land and the building. But at this point, we're trying to get DED the authority to handle that themselves, as opposed to working with split estates and the building being sold by one group and the land by another, and just trying to provide them with more authority to dispose of their properties.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Mr. Parsons, if you could please continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Puckettuck. So one of the things that we've looked at as we were challenged to try to figure out how do we get more Alaska land into Alaskans' hands is in 2000, when the land sale program was originally reestablished, it generated the Land Disposal Income Fund. And this was an opportunity for us to account for monies that came in from our land sales. And at up to $5 million stayed in that fund, available to the division, to the department, to do capital improvements, to build roads, to do surveys, designs, those types of things. That amount has not been changed since 2000. And so with the effects of inflation, increase in cost of materials, of surveyors, a certain portion of the staff that does this work is paid for out of the LDIF. That money available that's left after our direct costs has shrunk significantly, and we may have less than, or just over, let's say $500,000 for actual capital projects to build roads, put in the infrastructure necessary for us to sell property, especially in the organized boroughs. So what this does is this basically raises that cap, takes into account inflation, and then bumps it just a little bit so that we're a few years out before we'd have to revisit this, and we move that from $5 million to $12 million. This is not an appropriation. This is just simply the raising the limit on that fund before the funds are automatically swept at the end of the fiscal year into the general fund.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, I think you answered it, my question there at the end. But the Land Disposal Income Fund has been considered a sweepable fund, correct?
Representative Hannah, through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
How often have you been able to keep $5 million in there most years to assist in, so separate from the sweep question, Or so are we at that cap now? I certainly see the need to increase it, but I'm just curious, since 2000, have we been able to keep $5 million in there to annually keep the land disposal program having the capital assets to keep going? Or is it only some years when there have been good land sales and several years where you don't?
Representative Hanna, through the chair, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. And what we have wound up with is the short answer to the question is right now we are producing a little over $5 million through our annual land sales. So we are at that max. What we don't know, we have an idea. There are several projects that we have had to shelve because we didn't have the authority or the ability to build roads, put in infrastructure, and take the necessary steps to comply with the planning authorities of the local municipalities to bring those higher profit, higher value land disposals onto the market. By increasing this cap, that will allow us to, you know, keep some of that money in to fund those larger, more expensive projects.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon, Mr. Parsons. And I guess the one thing that I would ask is if you can give us a snapshot going back maybe the last five fiscal years, what that sweepable amount has been above the $5 million.
Absolutely, Chair Puckatuck. We will get that, and if you would like, we will also provide a list of those projects that we have not been able to move forward due to the lack of funding or lack of available cap.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. It'll just give me some justification as far as upping the amount. Representative Shragi.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Just making sure I understand what I'm reading here correctly and pairing that with what you've previously said. So this doesn't require an appropriation. This working capital is funded through the sale of lands. Is that correct? Can you clarify that for me?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch who the question was from. Representative
Shragi.
Shragi? Yes, that is correct. This is not an appropriation. This just allows more of the funds that come in through the land disposal sale to stay with the program. To increase the program.
Okay, thank you. And follow up, if I may.
Follow up, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, so you talk about developing some of these lands to, I assume, get them to a point where they're actually attractive for sale, and you believe that you would be able to identify buyers that would bid on these lands. What kind of vetting for those projects is there? What kind of public process is there? How do you decide whether or not to develop one of those pieces of property to help bring them to a point that would be attractive to a buyer?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, we have a fairly detailed process that we've developed in-house so that we look at an area that would be up for development. Let's say it's in the Fairbanks North Star borough. We would look at that. We would identify where roads could go in, how many lots we think we could possibly develop within that area. We will look at land sales that are in that area, comparables. We have our appraisal group work with our design group so that we get an idea of what's the market look like, what's the value of the land, what's the cost to put the roads in, is the amount of revenue that we would generate through the sale above or at or above what it would cost to put the infrastructure in. And if it doesn't pass that test, then it doesn't go forward. If it does, then we write a preliminary decision that goes out to the public, to the various agencies that we work with, goes to the public, to area ANCSA corporations and to tribal governments to look at and to vet and get public input. Does this make sense? You know, what do you know that we don't? How can we change this? If there are changes that we see necessary through the information that we get through that public process, then we amend what the design might look like or the number of parcels that we would offer, and then it goes to a final finding and decision. Then it goes out and we start the actual layout on the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Shragi, follow-up?
You know, one last follow-up, channeling my best Representative Kaufman. I'm going to ask, what kind of metrics do you have for evaluating? So you talked about you evaluate the what you believe you could get for the property. There would never be a situation where you invest more in bringing a property to a point that it's sellable than you would actually collect. And there, I assume there's some sort of internal standard for what kind of return you would need on those upgrades.
Representative Shragi, through the chair, we don't have a rate of return of 9%, 15%, 20%. What we look at that, can we cover the costs of the development based on what we think the fair market value is, again, through the appraisal process. And then once it goes into the open market and the bids start to come in many cases, we know we can cover our costs and maybe make a little bit on it. But then the market takes over and that's really, it's been, I won't say difficult's not the right word, but depending on the year, we can be very accurate in our estimates, or we can receive bids that are quite a bit higher than what we had anticipated. To my knowledge, we have not put a project forward that we didn't at least cover costs on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Parsons, I guess the other thing that I would ask in regards to that for a follow-up would be if you can, you or your team can put on paper kind of that in-house policy of keeping the public engaged as to what goes up for sale and what doesn't, that might be good for the committee members. With that, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Just trying to wrap my head around how this process might have been used. Was this what was used to develop and make available the agricultural land outside of Nenana?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, that's a little bit different process. Director Shady can speak to the process that the Division of Agriculture has put forward. We work in cooperation with them to help form the sale and administer the sale. But as far as the metrics that the Division of Agriculture uses, I think Director Shady would be best to answer that.
Director Shady.
I don't need that answer right now. I was just curious if it was used there. There's a whole agriculture section later. I can ask that question later if it's available. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, you know, one other thing that just occurred to me as I pulled up my little calculator and punched some numbers. So you had a $5 million cap and want to increase this for inflation, but also just to increase your ability to develop these properties. Just adjusting for inflation would be an addition. You'd need an additional $2.5 million to bring it up to 7.5 over 20 years at 2% inflation. So this is double the growth that you would need to cover inflation. I guess is there that? I know you're going to get us a list, but just offhand, is there that substantial of a backlog of properties that need investment to bring them to sale? I mean, why do you need the additional $4.5 million?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, again, we're catching up with inflation, and again, dependent on the number that you use, and then we have taken it beyond that to be able to make sure we don't have to continue to come back on a regular basis, you know, annual or maybe every couple of years, to look for an increase so that we can have we know going into the future what our cap is, and we can work towards that. I will say that there are several projects that when we looked at actually putting the roads into to the borough standards that were requested by the borough and their planning authority may have increased our cost by tenfold, gone from, you know, $50,000-$60,000 to put in roads to over $500,000, and that was just one small project. So road construction and the necessity, especially when working within the organized boroughs, you know, they obviously have needs as far as roads to make sure that they have, you know, ingress and egress for emergency emergency equipment to make sure that traffic can evacuate from an area if necessary, as opposed to just a small one-lane road with turnouts. Their requests are for, two-lane roads, infrastructure that needs to be put in as far as electrical, those types of things. So, yeah, the cost to put in a subdivision within one of the boroughs, especially close to what's already been developed, can be rather high.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shragg and Mr. Parsons. Further questions before we move on with the presentation? Seeing or hearing none, Mr. Parsons, please continue.
Thank you. So one of the things that had kind of struck us as we brainstormed how we might be able to put more Alaska lands into production was the necessity for land to be available for entrepreneurs, business people that have an idea that need state land to base their operations from, but aren't necessarily keen on the idea of making a nomination for a piece of land and then going through the regular competitive process and hope that they're the successful bidder or someone else could see the same idea and outbid them for that particular parcel. So one of the things we thought about was how do we make land available for someone in an area where they want to develop, a fishing lodge, that they could get a parcel of ground, they could establish it, they could build their lodge, they could be fairly certain that somebody else wasn't going to buy that land out from underneath them. And this was an opportunity for someone to nominate a piece of ground. They would provide us a legal description. They'd have it appraised. We would work with them on what their development plan was, what they intended to do. Like I say, it could be a lodge. Might be someone. I know in Southeast Alaska at one time there was a group that was going to bring an experimental aircraft manufacturer facility in. They might need a place to build the actual manufacturing facility with a runway. So those types of industries could come to the state and say, we need X number of acres to build this. We look at that plan. Looks like a plan that would help expand the state's economy. We could enter into a lease with those individuals. They could start to build their facilities, bring us reports that say, yep, we've done what we said we were going to do in our plan, and allow us then to wind up selling that land to them to help with the idea of helping to diversify our economy. Now, this would only be for commercial use. It wouldn't be for recreational use, but we think this is a really interesting idea. We kind of looked at, on the federal government side, they have economic opportunity zones, I believe, where there was certain funds available to help companies grow and to get started. And we looked at the same type of idea and what assets we have that the state could best use, and that would be state land. So that's what this particular portion of the bill does.
Thank you, Representative Hannon.
Mr. Parsons, I'm struggling to just clearly understand. So if I'm a commercial developer and I see a piece of property I want and the state agrees to it, then I get a sole source negotiation and lease of that land? Or is it I'm a commercial developer, I see a piece of property that I have going to build my drone airport testing ground on, and then I ask you to put it up and a variety of people can comment and lease it?
Representative Hannah, through the chair, yes. and I say that because there's two different ways that this program could work. Either someone brings a piece of land to us, use the drone development as an idea, where they would say we need a facility of 10 acres for construction, and then we want to have another testing area or landing strip for another 10. Then we would look at that, and we could make that land available to them at fair market value. It's not, we wouldn't give them the land. They would have to purchase the land. So they would enter into a lease under fair market value. And then if they went through the steps that they said they were going to do as far as their development, and the state could see that, yes, they are building a facility, they are putting people to work, they are testing their drones on the land, then if they requested, we could convert that from a lease to a sale. There's also the opportunity in this bill for the commissioner to identify areas and solicit, solicit ideas for what industries might work, people who are interested. And at that point, if we had multiple individuals that came forward or multiple companies that came forward and said, hey, we'd like to use this piece of land for this, then that would have to be evaluated on what returns the highest amount to the state.
So, follow up? Okay. Okay. Any other questions? We've got Representative Rausch or Hopkins and Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I was just wondering, it's one simple question, is who pays for the assessment of the property? I think I talked to the DNR a few years back. Somebody wanted to purchase a hanging chad left over when the highway got moved, and basically they were supposed to soak up the cost of the assessment, and it was worth more than the land. I'm just wondering, who pays for the assessment here?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, the individual, whether it's a company or the person that's bringing this forward, would be responsible for the survey and for the appraisal.
All right, thank you very much.
And just to clarify, that's through the commercial nomination process.
Chair Puttkatuck, that is correct.
Okay, and so in the other process, the state might carry the bill on the appraisal when it goes to competitive bid?
Chair Puttkatuck, I believe that is correct. If the state were to offer a parcel, that would be correct. We would already have identified it. If we just identified an area and then requested, let's say we put a section of land, 640 acres out, and said, people, anybody that's interested in using this, let us see what type of ideas you had. Three people came forward and they were scattered out throughout that 640 acres with no overlap, then they would be responsible for it. If there were two competing organizations that wanted the same parcel or those parcels overlap, then it would go to the high bidder, and again they would have been responsible for the survey and for the appraisal. If the state offered a discrete parcel, then the state would have surveyed and appraised that parcel before it went out.
Thank you for that, Mr. Parsons. Follow-up, Representative Rausch.
Yeah, is that in the bill, or is that in regulations you can adopt later?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I'm looking through it real quick. It's my recollection that is in the bill.
Okay, maybe we can...
All right, thank you.
Maybe we can flip back to that and clarify once somebody on your team is able to.
I think he's not done, but I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Thanks again, Mr. Parsons. How does the state determine if they are not responsible for the assessment of that property, that it is a fair assessment?
Representative, through the chair, they would have to provide us with an appraisal, which we would provide appraisal instructions for what the appraisal would need to include, and so then we would review that appraisal and make sure that it met our standards.
Follow the standards are a checkbox. Did you look at this? Did you look at that? Sort of thing. I'm assuming. And so I guess my concern is I'm a land developer and I have an in-house appraiser and I get a solid appraisal from my in-house appraiser. They checked all the boxes, but how do you know that that's legitimate appraisal value that you're going to be selling it at?
Representative, through the chair, our in-house appraisal staff reviews all of those appraisals and makes sure that they meet the standards developed under USPAP. So they would identify the appraisal instructions of what they need to identify as part of the process, and then they would review the appraisal and determine whether we accepted that or not.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the question was towards whether or not there's enough checks and balances in the appraisal process to make sure that the state's not getting gypped.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. I think of the appraisal that I had done on my house, and I know you have to find similar properties to vet that appraisal against, and I assume that there's some standards like that with appraisals of this nature as well, but that would be something that I think the committee would be interested in getting some more information on, just to clarify. I wanted to circle back to the issue of bringing properties up to a point to where they're sellable. I mean, to what extent would the state be covering costs that really should be paid by the person that purchases the property to put in? I know a subdivision was mentioned. I mean, is this intended to extend a state road out to be able to access an area where these lands are for sale, or does the state actually undertake putting in infrastructure on the property that would then benefit a developer or someone that's building a lodge, that sort of thing? I'm trying to understand what exactly the scope of those upgrades are and whether or not the state should be paying for those upgrades or the private buyer should be paying for those upgrades.
Representative, through the chair, if it's a subdivision that the state is selling individual parcels within, then in order for the state to meet the requirements under the planning boards within the organized boroughs, then the state is required in most cases to build the roads to those standards, the main roads into it, to subdivide the parcels, to put in the corners, in some cases bring in electricity. We are the subdivider. We are the developer, and so then people come in and buy the individual lots. At that point, they're responsible for clearing the lot, putting in driveways, running power from the trunk lines into their homes, water, those types of things. So the basic infrastructure is in place if the state's selling a subdivision, especially within the organized boroughs. In some cases where it's a remote parcel, if we're looking at the commercial development program that we're discussing here, the state doesn't guarantee any type of constructed access. That's up to them to develop that access. So it kind of depends on which program we're talking about.
Okay, thank you. That helps clarify things greatly. And then I have one more follow-up,
if the chair allows.
Thank you, through the chair. So just circling back to a private individual nominating lands to be sold by the state to them, I understand they have to get the appraisal done and pay for that themselves. But just to clarify on Representative Hannon's question, if they nominate that property and get the appraisal done, does that go up to any sort of bid, or is it just directly offered to that individual for sale? Is there any opportunity for others to bid on that property?
Under the commercial use program, this is an opportunity for someone to identify commercial use, provide the state with a development plan on what they intend to use it for, enter into a lease, so that they can start to develop those lands. The state can monitor to make sure that the lands are being used for the purposes that the plan established, and then they get the opportunity to convert that straight into a sale without going through the competitive process.
Okay, thank you.
So just to clarify, Mr. Yeah. Parsons, it says the leasing option. Is it truly an option? Can you go directly to sale without engaging in a lease first before it converts into a sale opportunity?
Under this program, Representative Puckettuck, we would go to a lease first and then go to a sale. They may follow very close behind, but it's one of the things that the state's going to want to make sure that someone is just not coming in, getting a particular piece of property on speculation and then not developing it. By going to a lease first, it allows the state to make sure that the land is going to be used for what it was intended to.
Thank you, and Is there a limit on that time frame as far as it needs to be leased for at least a year or 2 years before you can have the opportunity to purchase through the commercial nomination process?
Representative Puckett, there's no limitation in the bill. It would be unusual for someone to be able to enter into a lease and then within a month move to sale, but there's no guidelines, but that's something that we could certainly look to as far as our regulations that we'll have to make sure that we adopt in order to implement this. And there's an RFP process that we go through, a request for proposal, and a lot of that can be taken up as part of that RFP, is how long they will be under lease before they'll be allowed to convert to a purchase.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative McKay, was it in regards to commercial land use? Okay, we'll come back to you. We got Representative Rauscher, then Representative Hannon on this topic.
Yeah, thank you very much, through the chair. Just one question now. Where does the estimate of the value of the land fall? Is that after you present your usage plan and it's accepted, or is it part of that? And so if your usage is denied, the state now has an idea of what the property is worth and it costs you that. How does it work?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, if I understand your question, we're talking about the survey and appraisal, and where does that fall in the process? The appraisal is not a use-based appraisal; it's what the land, the raw land, is worth. So, you know, we don't appraise it. Well, if they're going to put this on it, it's worth this, and if they put something else on, it's worth five times that. It's worth what the raw land would sell for. Part of going out, or the presentation, it would be a back and forth with someone who wanted to do something, so that the state had an idea that this was a good use of the land, but there is some risk that the individual would take on by surveying and appraising prior to going to lease.
So through the follow-up
representative.
So then you do have to do all that before your usage is accepted. And so wouldn't you want to get your use accepted before you put all the money into the survey and the estimate of the land, instead of having it all at once, so that the state now actually gets a free estimate if they turn down your usage?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, it would be an assumption on that there would be a if someone's going to nominate a parcel, that they would come to the state and have a conversation prior to making their proposal. And there would be a certain idea that idea would be accepted before they went forward with that much. I wouldn't assume that someone would go out, survey and have a land appraised and then come to the state, and that would be the first time they start talking about what they want to do. There would be conversations with, are there any things out there that would restrict our use, or are there land classifications that have to be changed, or I am envisioning quite a dialogue prior to getting to the point where an individual would go out and survey and appraise the land.
I appreciate it. That was the question.
Thank you
very
Representative Rauscher, Mr. Parsons. Representative Shragi. Representative Hopkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the final bullet point on this slide, the number of acres identified for proposed development will be significant, and the number of acres conveyed will depend on the parcels received. What does significant mean in this context, and are there any type of land that are currently qualified as opportunity zones, or are there other types of lands that would not be available for this type of bidding process?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, of course, lands that are set aside in legislatively designated areas would not be available. There are, You could look anywhere, potentially, but if you wanted to put some type of installation on top of lands that were classified for mineral and it significantly impacted the state's ability to develop those minerals, that would be an area that the state would have to have a clear understanding of why it's in the best interest to do that. If it's habitat land, what you want to do in that habitat land, will it negatively affect the land's ability to still function? In the larger area, do you have a 5-acre piece in a 100,000-acre parcel, or do we have a 50-acre piece in a 200-acre parcel? All of those types of things come into play in determining whether the activity is going to be in the state's best interest or not. Most land that is not set aside in LDAs could be considered as part of this as under this program. The big thing they would have to do is there has to be a reclassification of those lands if it is not properly classified for disposal. So if there were habitat lands where someone wanted to put in a fishing lodge, then, there would have to be a reclassification before we could actually convey that land to them.
Follow-up, Representative Hopkins.
Chair, and what is the process for reclassifying that land? Is that legislative or is that administrative?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, it's administrative and it's a public process. So someone would come to us and say, and it wouldn't matter whether it was under this program or any other reason that someone might come to us and say, I think this land is really better suited for remote recreation as opposed to settlement. And then we would have to look at it, go out to the public, receive public comments, work our way through the reclassification process that ultimately goes up to the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources for signature and is then available for reconsideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative McKay, then Representative Shragi.
Okay, I just had one quick question. I might as well get in the join the parade here. Thank you for your testimony. Through the chair, just quick question. I assume that you check for archaeological remnants, ancient graveyards, things that are historic in nature on these properties. I come from the oil industry, and we always had to do that whenever we were building a new drill pad. We always had to check and make sure there were no like an ancient hunting ground or anything where there might be artifacts from our ancestors. So can you address that question?
Representative McKay, through the chair, yes. That's all part of the process before the state can convey land out of state ownership.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Further questions before we move on, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my wheels are spinning. You keep using the example of a fishing lodge, but I'm going to use the example of a shellfish farm that 30 years ago, when those were first being done, the controversy was we don't want these commercial enterprises being leased out long-term as commercial enterprise, but really you're just trying to get a beachfront chunk of land to yourself. So if I've been shellfish farming on a parcel for the last 30 years, can I nominate that and get it converted into a sell to me? Because I've already, if I meet these, or could somebody come in and next door to me, where I've never been able to have a purchase of the land, but I've been leasing it from the state for 20, 30, 5 years doing shellfish farming. Can somebody else come in and now buy land just down the bay from me and say I'm going to do a shellfish farm, but because they're through this new legislation, they're able to purchase that land after the 5 years of commercial enterprise? So how does it affect our current commercial leases on land that they've leased from DNR? And what prevents basically somebody else going, well, that was a great idea, but I'm going to just do it for 5 years, and then it's going to be my beachfront home?
Representative Hanna, through the chair, this program is for uplands only. The state is basically, through statute, barred from conveying tide lands and submerged lands to anyone except for a municipality under Title 38. So it in the case where we look at aquatic farming now, all of those are handled under a lease with, and there is no opportunity to purchase those submerged lands. This commercial use is for uplands only. And if someone already had a lease, somebody else would not be able to come in and set something on top of them and take that land away from them.
Representative Hannon, follow-up.
Through the chair. Mr. Parsons, let me clarify that. I understand that the shellfish themselves are out on the tide lands, and that was not really in question, but at all those commercial shellfish farms, they also mostly have an uplands permit for their shoreside cabin to live in, because the thing about shellfish is they do need very regular monitoring. Almost all the shellfish farms across Alaska have an uplands lease for land. Could I get that piece transferred? I've been commercially growing oysters out in the front on the tidelands. I understand that continues under a lease with the state, but can I now purchase my uplands lease?
Representative Hanna, through the chair, if you provided a nomination for a parcel of land and through the justification of what you were going to use it for, you know, not just for a beach, for a residence, under the commercial aspects of this, we would look at, is there some type of component where the oysters are actually processed? Is there a necessity for that upland operations, or is there going to be transportation out of there? What type of commercialization goes along with that would all have to be part of the proposal that was provided to the state to enter into that lease that could be subsequently turned into a purchase when it was shown that the processes that were identified in the proposal were being actually put into effect.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. I had a question, but it blanked me. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. So Representative Hannon now has my mind spinning, and I'm just wondering, so, I mean, if someone were to nominate a parcel at the foot of a glacier for a lodge or a construction shop or something like that, and then after the lease is converted to a sale, are they then able to sell it sometime thereafter for just personal use? Can you clarify that for me?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, if it was sold, then the person would be able to, there wouldn't be a covenant on there that went with it that restricted it for commercial use. I'm looking through the bill real quick because I do not remember a stipulation in there that required it to remain in commercial use, similar to the stipulations that we have on ag parcels when we sell them for agriculture.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shragi and Mr. Parsons. So commercial operations upland that currently have leases that maybe expire in the next, I don't know, pick a year, after this piece of legislation goes into effect, is there anything that speaks to almost the grandfather in ability to, now that this is an option through legislation, even though my lease expires in 2025, this bill was passed in 2021 or 2022, can I come out from under that lease and now nominate it to be sold? Can you kind of speak to that aspect of it?
Representative Puckatuck, through the chair, there's always an opportunity to extend the lease. In most cases, let's say we do a 25-year lease, then at the end of that 25 years, there's an option to extend for an additional 25-year period. So if you were coming up against your coming up to where your lease would terminate, go through the extension process, and then if you wanted to provide that, we could convert that lease to a lease under this particular program that would allow you to then purchase the land.
Right. So, but I would have to wait until my current lease ended. And to Representative Hannon's, I guess, example, somebody would be able to come in right next to me and outright purchase it, dump a bunch of capital into the property, and, you know, perform better than I could with whatever business entity it was, because I'm currently operating under this lease status where I'm, you know, careful to invest because it's only a lease. Would I then have the opportunity, now that this legislation passes, that if I wanted to convert from a lease to a sale, I don't have to wait until my end of lease?
Representative Puckett, yes. There would be nothing that would stop the state from converting, either terminating the existing lease and then entering into a new lease for that same parcel. Under this program, we would look to the regulations as to how people who have existing leases could convert those to a lease under this program, so that those entrepreneurial activities are protected. It's not the intent of this program to run someone off when they've done all the work to develop that that industry. So we would look to regulations on how we would work to convert those existing upland leases to a lease under this particular program if a development plan was presented to us.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Hopkins?
No.
All right. Well, you can continue with your presentation, seeing as we have no questions.
Okay, very good.
One page at a time.
One page at a time. And now, Director Dave Shady of the Division of Agriculture will be able to walk us through some of the changes that are made to the Ag Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Shady. I'm the Director of the Division of Agriculture in the Department of Natural Resources. So in a nutshell, we have a lot of ag parcels out there with ag covenants. You have old title and you have new title. So in 1986, the legislature made some great improvements to land and how we sold with title subject to covenants, which has helped the ability of farmers to grow and to get financing. But we still find some detrimental limitations to the reading of the statute, which was written originally in the 60s based on traditional agriculture. And we're finding that we're not up to date. So what the first part of this change is, we want to allow for the land use and improvements of ag covenant land to include more modern activities that can bring cash into that farm, but they must continue not to limit the primary use for agriculture purposes. And our examples are, we have folks that want to run a bed and breakfast that is designed around having people come out and learn where their food is grown. Somebody has an opportunity to put a cell tower on their property, so they have cell service out in that area. And we don't think that's going to have a significant impact on agriculture purposes, but the current reading of the statute by the Department of Law says those are not allowed uses, and so we're trying to make that to where it's more usable, and we work to develop our agricultural industries. We also have a statute that says in these ag covenants, if you have large parcels, you can subdivide them up into four pieces with a minimum of 40 acres. And this package allows that to go to eight parcels, and it brings that limitation down to 20 acres. One of the additional things that this statute does that we've added in is that we realize that in our ag areas, we need infrastructure opportunities. And so this statute allows the state to promote in the examples in Nanatot-Chackett, to where we can have parcels between 5 and 20 acres, for example, and that has increased allowed uses. That is for those support industries to also be allowed on that property. So you might have 5 acres and it's a peony farm, or it's growing radishes or carrots, but it also could be a dealership, a tractor dealership, or something that supports what's going on in that area. This also allows that if the subdivided parcels on current lands are at the 20-acre limit, then they also could then be used for more ancillary role. So in a nutshell, what we're trying to do is make agricultural covenant land more user-friendly and to actually increase agricultural use of our lands we have around the state.
Thank you, Director Shady. Questions, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shady, first, I guess I better do the reveal that I used to work for Senator Petula, who was instrumental in the ag covenant, so I just feel a little pull to be a little defensive about parceling out land, and especially in the Mat-Su Valley, into smaller parcels. But with that said, looking at modern agriculture and the couple examples you gave of Department of Law saying you couldn't run a bed and breakfast on your ag parcel because it's not ag land, and this change in the statute would allow it. Would it also require, though, that they are not just running a bed and breakfast or not just leasing for a cell tower, that they are conducting ag?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, under ag covenants, it is required that you continue in agriculture. But because of the limitations, we've had a difficult time of actually doing a reasonable job, in my opinion, and I'm the director, of enforcing those covenants. So the first step is to try to make sure it's clear what those allowable uses are, to make those more reasonable, and then we will actually take on a more active role of enforcing our covenant says that this land is supposed to be and continue in ag production.
Follow up. So, Mr. Shady, what's the trade-off to, is it by percent of earned income or area of acreage that I have to be using to comply with the ag covenant but still allow tractor dealership, bed and breakfast, cell tower there? So as long as I've got some, I'm milking one goat, or do I have to have 50% in ag? Because it's not clear in the statute, and since I haven't had the experience of you having to work all these years and finding out from the Department of Law that some of those things are completely banned under the ag covenants, I'm just trying to make sure we're not going so far away that we become it's just an ag covenant name, but really it's a tractor dealership or it's a bed and breakfast growing a box of peonies in front of it.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, Director Shady again, you're asking the million-dollar question. I mean, it's the one we struggle with. What level of agriculture is agriculture? That's a difficult thing to answer. So one of the reasons why, I've argued for and worked on these ancillary uses to be in small on the smaller parcels is that's all that's necessary, and we want to keep our traditional larger farming enterprises on the larger parcels. So the only entity that can go to the small parcels is the state of Alaska for the future. It has been a long discussion of the minimum from 40 to 20 acres. There was a lot of folks that would like to see them at 5 acres. I was one that have argued pretty ferociously that it's a 20-acre limit because you need to be able to move your farm around that land. Even if you're only using 5 acres, you need to be able to do your rotations and that in your traditional agriculture. I think once this bill is passed, it'll be incumbent upon the department to write some regulations that clarifies how we're going to clearly reach those decisions so that they're not arbitrary and capricious, because really there's no metric right now, and that is one of our problems.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Shady. Almost went to the old enunciation. Any other questions from committee members before we move on with the presentation? Seeing or hearing none, please move on.
Not hearing you, Marty.
Mr. Parsons.
All right, good afternoon again. Thank you, Director Shady. Chair Puckatuck, so we will continue with our working our way through the bill. One of the things that we had in a bill that we introduced last year was for the state to become the planning authority within organized boroughs. Currently, the organized boroughs have that authority to them so that they approve what type of development goes on within the boundaries of their borough or municipality. In some cases, it was causing the state to have to take certain projects off the table because of the expenses that were being required for development that the planning boards were asking the state to put into place. Obviously, that did not go well with the municipalities, and through the Alaska Municipal League, we worked very hard to come up with a solution that we feel that everybody will benefit from. And so that major change in the way we did business within the organized boroughs basically got narrowed down to the state will only be held to the same standards as what a private developer will be held to. So if a private developer were going to have to build roads to a collector standard, then the state would only have to build roads to a collector standard. We wouldn't have to go up to an arterial standard, which is, you know, wider, better shoulders, different types of drainage structures, those types of things. So really, through a cooperative effort with the Municipal League, we came up with a way to move forward for the state to develop their lands within the boundaries of the municipalities and be held to the same standards as what a private developer would be held to.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Parsons, where in the bill is that language?
That is, if we look at the bill, I believe it's section two, construction standards.
Thank you.
Basically, the language says a right-of-way width must conform to the subdivision control ordinances of the municipality in the same manner and to the same extent as private owners, as private landowners.
Thank you.
You may is there a follow-up, Representative Hannon?
No.
Okay, you may continue.
All right, thank you, Chairman. Let's see. Okay, where'd I go? And then the last thing that we have in the bill is there's a lot of different cleanup languages that needed to take place. One of the things that the state was not able to do was able to take advantage of, say, online auctions, just simply because of the wording of the statute. It said required, and we changed it to allowed. So that means that we could actually enter into an online auction offering to take advantage of some of the new technologies that weren't available back in 2000. We've also looked at expanding our contracts to 30 years instead of 20 years. We think this will help Alaskans to spread that cost of their land over a longer period, reducing the payments. The state has a very generous sale contract program that basically people who are Alaska residents can get into, and so the state basically finances that land till the end of purchase. And the other thing that we did is we removed the root word foreclosure and replaced it with termination. And this was something that we worked closely with the Department of Law on. Foreclosure gives an idea that we're going to go in and we're going to take the land back, and we're going to take everything that's on the land, and that's not the case. So by replacing foreclosure with termination, we can terminate the contract, but we still allow people who have had personal property on there a certain amount of time to get that property off if we've had to terminate their contract. So that's really kind of some cleanup language in the bill, and that, I believe, is the end of the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So with online auctions, love the idea of modernizing the process. I can think of a number of my neighbors and constituents, though, that while it's less common nowadays, They still don't have a computer or access to the internet on a daily basis. Is there a way that they would still be able to participate in those auctions, or would they be excluded from the process?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, at this point, we don't have a program set up where we would only be doing online auctions, and that, of course, is one of the things that we would have to take into account, is how do we make sure, especially in our initial land offering, that Alaskans have that opportunity to purchase first. Currently we have a program where we do an auction, and then any lands that are not sold on that auction, they go into to what we call an over-the-counter sale, and it's something that we've discussed, that maybe some of those lands that are in the over-the-counter program, one or two of them at a time, could be put into an online auction, just to generate some other interest in the program. So it's nothing that we have a set idea going forward on how we're going to do it. This just gives us the opportunity to do it.
Thank you, and I would imagine that we'd like to keep the participation at a paper level still available versus just strictly going to an online.
Yeah, follow up, if I may.
Follow up, Representative Shragi.
Would this bill allow, potentially, not that this would be the direction that you would head, but should you decide to head this direction, would this bill allow you to have an online-only option?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, I believe that would be a possibility.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Further questions from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, I want to thank Mr. Parsons, Mr. Shady, and also Mr. Orman. I know you're listening in the background there, making sure we don't have any legalese questions. But I want to thank you guys for the presentation, and the plan is to pick this bill up again at some point. But for now, we'll set it aside. And with that concludes today's business. We've noticed a couple of meetings for next week, but as we're all aware, we need to get through some of the work on the budget first, so that's susceptible to whatever happens with our floor sessions. But with that, we'll be hearing HCR 2, which is a concurrent resolution by Speaker Stutz. She'll be presenting that. And also, have a good weekend, and I'll see you guys all here this weekend. So, meeting's adjourned at 2:46 p.m.